All right, let's continue our newspaper coverage for this Monday, the 8th of June, 2026. And we say hello with the Boston Herald to Alicia.
Hello, everybody. Happy Monday. And here are your stories from today's Boston Herald. Demand not living up to the hype. Experts say prices have come down for Bay State Airbnb listings during the World Cup. By Lance Reynolds. Property owners across the region who look to score big off Airbnb listings during the World Cup are not seeing as much interest as initially hyped, according to some local real estate experts. As winter turned to spring and temperatures rose, property owners across Greater Boston listed housing units on Airbnb for the World Cup, some for over $30,000 a week. But it didn't take long for those prices to come down. Roger Lee, a community leader for Airbnb hosts in Massachusetts, says geopolitics, transportation costs to get to and from Boston Stadium, and soaring ticket prices are contributors to a relatively stagnant rental property inventory. We aren't really seeing the original hyped-up numbers that were predicted, Lee told the Herald on Sunday, 6 days before Scotland and Haiti face off in the first match of the premier global tournament in Foxborough. Lee, a short-term rental property manager who has 20 homes in the region, primarily south of Boston, said he's seen international travelers looking more for 1 to 2 bedroom properties for less than $300 a night, with a stay of fewer than 3 nights. It really kind of told us that the people coming from abroad aren't going to be spending thousands of dollars for this event, Lee said. They're really more price conscious. Though they aren't as hot a commodity as expected, very luxurious rental properties with 4 or more bedrooms are still an attraction for incoming fans, Lee said. These homes, though, have at least some history on Airbnb. When a guest is traveling, he said, they want to make sure it has a reputation. Boston Stadium is set to host 7 matches, 5 in the group stage and 2 knockout games, starting Saturday and lasting through July 9th. The World Cup is considered a Tier 1 event, the highest risk level for public gatherings in the country. Local soccer enthusiasts will be converging with fans from England, France, Ghana, Haiti, Iraq, Morocco, Norway, and Scotland. David Cutler, a South Shore realtor who has tracked Airbnb listings around the World Cup as a public service and a blog, said he's excited about the tremendous opportunity that area property owners have during the tournament. But the key to seeing success, Cutler said, is to list intelligently and not be greedy. The average nightly Airbnb cost for the week of June 13th, he said, is between $440 and $660. The demand, he said, is really not living up to the hype. In a blog post in early May, Cutler highlighted a Walpole 4-bedroom with a pool and in walking distance of Gillette Stadium that listed at $12,941 for 7 nights. And a waterfront 5-bedroom in Foxborough at $24,660. The property that topped them all came in at $32,353 for a week, a Walpole property with a backyard oasis. The common denominator across the board for people is, I have never done anything like this before. I don't want international guests in my house who aren't from here, Cutler told the Herald on Sunday. And I mean that respectfully, he added. I don't think anyone has meant it with a xenophobic intention. Airbnb corporate leaders have lauded how the World Cup is set to be the biggest hosting event in Airbnb's history, surpassing the 2024 Olympic and Paralympic Games in Paris. An economic impact study that Deloitte conducted for Airbnb, published earlier this spring, estimated that roughly 164,000 tourists would be traveling to Boston for the tournament, a figure that included 17,000 Airbnb guests. The study also revealed that local hosts would benefit significantly during the World Cup, with total earnings estimated to reach nearly $16 million. These earnings could be particularly impactful for women, who represent 59% of Airbnb hosts in the USA, the study stated, and for seniors, who represent 20% of hosts. Internal data as of April 1st that Airbnb shared with the Herald on the Boston area neighborhoods with the highest shares of entire home listings available for under $500 a night showed West Revere, Salem Neck, and South Salem were pacing the Bay State. Staying in these communities, however, would require pricey public transit or ride shares to get to and from the matches in Foxborough. Town governments in the typically quaint suburbs of Foxborough and the surrounding area have hard regulations on short-term rentals, with most communities requiring properties to be rented out for at least 12 months. Because of local regulations, Lee said, a lot of people are shying away from listing because they don't want to get fined by the town. Jillian Lang has been an Airbnb host for about a year in Providence, renting out an accessory dwelling unit that features a living dining area with a bathroom, bedroom, and its own entry. Lang said Airbnb has made it possible for her to afford her home with the extra income. Her ADU started being taken as soon as matches were announced. Because this is a unit we would have opened anyway, Lang told the Herald, it is not changing the way we run our Airbnb, but it is exciting to be able to show off our neighborhood and our state. Board denies parole to youth group rapist by Rick Sobey. A church youth group leader who was convicted of raping a 12-year-old boy and sentenced to life in prison has been denied parole. Paul Hawksley, in the early 2000s, was one of the leaders of a youth group affiliated with Easton's Fellowship Church. Hawksley during this time repeatedly raped a 12-year-old boy who was a member of the youth group. Then, in 2012, Hawksley was convicted of rape of a child with force and rape of a child. He was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole and in 20 to 30 years, respectively, to run concurrently. Hawksley earlier this year got his first hearing in front of the Massachusetts Parole Board, which has now rejected the convicted rapist's bid for freedom. The parole board noted that Hawksley denies raping the boy, and there are other potential victims who never got justice. Mr. Hawksley has a history of prior incarceration for raping multiple children, which he admits to, the board wrote in its decision. The facts of all cases follow a similar pattern of predatory behavior and sexual offending. The board did not find his testimony regarding the current offense to be credible. The board reviewed the most recent sex offender treatment program report, which highlighted specific concerns and recommendations, the board added. Of additional concern, when asked if there were any additional victims that he sexually offended against, he stated, "I want to speak the truth, but I don't want to be brought up on other charges," showing a complete disregard for the suffering of victims for which he was never held accountable. The parole board's denial to the convicted rapist comes as the board faces heat in recent months for freeing dozens of first-degree murderers. In this case, the boy moved to Easton in 2003 and became involved in the youth group to meet new friends. Hawksley groomed the victim, calling him multiple times a day, inviting him to sleepovers, and singling him out with gifts and attention. On one occasion, the boy was playing dodgeball at a youth group meeting and left the group to use the church bathroom. Hawksley entered the bathroom and forced the boy to engage in oral sex. Hawksley, another time, brought the boy, along with Hawksley's family, to a Pawtucket Red Sox game. After the game, the group returned to Hawksley's house. Hawksley and the boy then went to play video games in the family's basement, where Hawksley sexually assaulted the boy. The parole board, in its ruling, noted that the testimony of the boy's family was credible and was considered in its decision. The board considered testimony in support of parole from Mr. Hawksley's friend, his sister, and his ex-wife, the board wrote. The board considered testimony in opposition to parole from three of the victim's family members. The board also considered testimony in opposition to parole from Bristol County Assistant District Attorney Sylvia Rudman and a written submission by retired Easton Police Sergeant Detective John Lynn. The board concludes by unanimous decision that Paul Hawksley has not demonstrated a level of rehabilitation that would make his release compatible with the welfare of society, the board added. The state's parole board has been in the news recently over the nomination of a former prosecutor to the board. The governor's council denied Vincent DeMore from joining the parole board, leading local DAs to rip the council for its outrageous vote. DeMore, who served 12 years as a prosecutor in the Suffolk DA's office, along with 7 years as a criminal defense attorney, would have been the lone ex-prosecutor on the parole board, which has been releasing dozens of first-degree murderers from prison. Now, after the denial of DeMore, the parole board still does not have a member with a prosecutorial background. Completely bogus on every front. Auditor blasts dodge by lawmakers on voter passed audit by Lance Reynolds. Entrenched in what she calls a dumpster fire amid her fight to conduct the voter-approved legislative audit, Diana DeZoglio says she is not focused on future political aspirations beyond state auditor. DeZoglio is also not budging on whether she will endorse Maura Healey for re-election, arguing that the governor has not spoken with her for over a year and a half. The auditor voiced her stances during an appearance on WCVB Channel 5's On the Record that aired Sunday, just days after the State House approved a bill that would block her from auditing the legislature's constitutional functions. DeZoglio said she thanks people for their vote of confidence when they suggest that she pursue higher political aspirations beyond the state auditor's office, but that isn't her plan for now. I will say this, my focus is entirely on getting reelected to the state auditor's office. I hope to have your vote and passing the public records reform ballot question, the auditor said. We need to stay focused and we cannot allow distractions to occur with considering this, considering that, we have work to do. Public records reform is a top priority that DeZoglio has stood on for months, as she has been blocked for over 19 months from conducting the audit of the state legislature that 72% of voters approved in November 2024. The ballot question she referred to on Sunday would expand the state public records law to include the legislature. Tensions between DeZoglio and the legislature, particularly Speaker Ron Mariano, continues to increase after the House of Representatives approved a so-called transparency bill in a 125-28 vote last week. The bill would allow DeZoglio to audit the administrative functions of both the House and Senate, but not their constitutional functions. The Senate still needs to greenlight it, and then Healey would decide whether to sign it into law. The legislation would only allow an audit of the limited records the Supreme Judicial Court outlined in its recent order, the adoption of the official budget by both chambers, expenditures, joint legislative operations, and monetary settlement agreements, all dating back to 2021. This is something that is completely bogus on every front, DeZoglio said. They're saying that this just limits the audit. No, what this does is it gives the speaker full control over the audit, like he's wanted this entire time. During DeZoglio's On the Record segment, WCVB aired a clip of Mariano speaking in the House debate last week, saying, as a result of this legislation, the auditor will be able to conduct the audit. That is completely false, DeZoglio said. We cannot call something an audit when the entity that we're auditing is controlling and calling the shots about what they're going to give us and not give us. DiSoglio also ripped Mariano over how the bill would bar the courts from adjudicating any future disputes regarding access to public records, instead establishing a dispute resolution process to avoid endless and costly legislation or litigation. Report, deadly domestic violence up. State Domestic Violence Fatality Review reports nearly 20% increase in 2024. By Colleen Cronin. Some domestic violence crimes like murder and non-negligent manslaughter are trending up in Massachusetts, according to a new statewide report. The State Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team's 2025 annual report noted there was a nearly 20% increase in those crimes in 2024 compared to 2023. There were 31 murders and non-negligent manslaughter related to domestic violence in 2024, which is the latest data, up from 26 the prior year. Domestic violence-related intimidation was also up about 8%, the report said. Despite those increases, other categories like simple and aggravated assault had decreased slightly. The team that drafted the report was created by a 2014 state law with the stated goal to decrease preventable domestic violence fatalities. Each year, in addition to looking at the statewide data, the team also looks at several specific fatalities and forms a report. Those listed among the members are State Attorney General Andrea Joy Campbell, State Police Colonel Jeffrey Noble, and Middlesex County District Attorney Marion Ryan, as well as representatives from the Office of Probation, Office of the Chief Medical Examiner, the Parole Board, and Executive Officer of Public Safety and Security, among others. This year, several themes emerged from our reviews that require our attention and action. We observed recurring patterns in crisis, judicial response, and funding, wrote the team's chair, Vilma Uribe, who is also the executive director of the Governor's Council to Address Sexual Assault, Domestic Violence, and Human Trafficking. These highlight both the challenges we face and the opportunities available to strengthen our system and save lives. This year's report made several recommendations, including amending the current statutes to include other offices, departments on the review team, like the Department of Public Health, the Department of Mental Health, and the Department of Children and Families. The report also recommends considering a pilot program for a domestic violence crisis emergency response team, which would work in the immediate aftermath to support survivors, as well as increased education for survivors, so that they understand their rights as their case moves through the legal system. It also noted that money that was allotted to domestic violence programming was almost slashed from the state's fiscal year 2026 budget. The report recommended not only finding stable funding for domestic violence programs, it asked that funding be increased. To those we have lost, we remember you. To those working to prevent future tragedies, thank you, Uribe wrote. To those experiencing violence, we see you, and support is available. Lawsuit seeks to stop the UFC fight at White House, from the Associated Press, New York. A federal lawsuit seeks to halt the upcoming UFC fight card on the White House South Lawn in a mixed martial arts show timed for President Donald Trump's 80th birthday and part of the celebration of the nation's 250th anniversary. The filing Saturday by the Public Integrity Project on behalf of two Virginia residents contends that the Trump administration's authorization of the June 14th event was unlawful. The lawsuit says such approval violated National Park Service regulations prohibiting sporting events on federal parklands. Congress did not consent to the towering arch overlooking the event space, and no environmental review was conducted before the construction. This is fundamentally a private, commercial, corrupt use of our most sacred national monuments for private gain, said Brendan Belew, a lawyer for the plaintiffs. And that is what is motivating this lawsuit. The White House said in a statement that the legal challenge was an obstructionist, baseless, and dilatory attempt to prevent Trump from hosting the fight, and that the event was no different than the various other White House-hosted events on the South Lawn and properly permitted events on the Ellipse and National Mall throughout the year. UFC did not immediately respond to a request for comment Sunday. Crews are erecting an octagon-shaped cage on the South Lawn. Trump has said the finished UFC project will feature a 5,000-seat arena right outside the front door of the White House. Additional large screens broadcasting the fights will be set up in a park at the nearby Ellipse, and the UFC has said it plans to issue as many as 85,000 free tickets to accommodate spectators at both locations. The octagon and surrounding structures are the latest project in the White House building boom Trump is leading. Tran Kin fined sentenced. Ex-lawmaker's sister pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice, by Colleen Cronin. The sister of former state senator Dean Tran will have to pay $40,000 and spend 2 years under supervised release for her role in a scheme involving the ex-legislator. Tuyet Martin, 56, of New Hampshire, was sentenced last week after pleading guilty to a federal obstruction of justice charge earlier this year, the Massachusetts U.S. Attorney's Office said. Martin wrote a fake employment offer letter for her brother that he used to obtain pandemic unemployment assistance, federal prosecutors said. After Tran was arrested and charged in November 2023, investigators took a look at the letter, which was from a New Hampshire business Martin both owned and ran. According to the U.S. attorney, Martin lied to federal law enforcement and under oath during a grand jury session about the letter. She said she authored the letter alone and signed it herself, even though prosecutors said it was actually reviewed and signed by Tran. The Herald reached out to attorneys for both Martin and Tran, but did not get a response back. Tran was sentenced to an extra month in prison in connection to charges stemming from the scam job offer. He pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice and making a false statement in December, before a federal judge tacked on the extra time to the 18-month sentence he was already serving for the earlier convictions, including 20 counts of wire fraud and 3 counts of filing a false tax return. According to court documents, Tran filed for pandemic unemployment the day after his term in the Massachusetts State Senate ended in January 2021. He used the letter from his sister without mentioning that they were related during an appeal process with the State Department of Unemployment Assistance a few months later. In total, he received more than $30,000 in PUA between March and September. While taking in the assistance, Tran also earned money as a consultant. He was charged additionally with failing to declare consulting income on his tax returns from 2020 to 2022. In addition to the prison sentence, Tran must also pay more than $58,000 in restitution, fines, and mandatory assessments. After the convictions and before the guilty pleas in federal court, Tran also pleaded guilty in June 2025 to stealing a gun from an older constituent while he was still in office. According to the state attorney general's office, Tran initially used his position as a lawmaker to convince the victim to sell her late husband's firearm collection, which consisted of 8 guns, for $1,500. After being asked to return the guns, Tran did so, but then returned when the victim was alone and stole another gun. The 6 months Tran received for pleading guilty to larceny of a firearm, misleading law enforcement in a criminal investigation, and filing an application for a license to carry containing false information were served concurrently with the federal charges. Tran, a Republican from Fitchburg, served in the legislature from 2017 to 2021. Motorcyclist killed in crash, driver charged with motor vehicle homicide by negligent operation, by Colleen Cronin. An Avon man with a suspended license was arrested after allegedly crashing into and killing another man on a motorcycle, the Bristol County District Attorney's Office announced. Jacon Larson, 22, has been charged with motor vehicle homicide by negligent operation and operating a motor vehicle while having a license suspended for operating under the influence, as well as a marked lanes violation and failure to yield, the DA's office said. Larson allegedly crashed into a motor vehicle at the intersection of South Street East and Hill Street just before noon Friday in Raynham. When police arrived on the scene, the DA said they found Scott Peach, 52, of New Bedford, lying on the road along with a heavily damaged Harley Davidson. Peach was taken to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead. Officers also observed the car Larson was driving, a white Ford Explorer, with heavy front-end damage, according to the DA. Larson stayed at the scene and spoke with police, who discovered that the suspect's license was suspended because of an OUI charge out of Taunton District Court. Larson is expected to be arraigned on the new charges Monday at Taunton District Court. The DA's office, the Mass State Police, and the Raynham Police Department are still investigating the incident. Teen facing gun fentanyl charges. Police say ghost gun dropped from waistband during chase. By Colleen Cronin. Boston police arrested a 17-year-old after a ghost gun allegedly fell out of his waistband during a foot chase. Officers said they noticed a group, including the suspect, in the parking lot area of Monsignor Reynolds Way around 6 p.m. on Friday while they were patrolling the Cathedral housing developments. When the officers entered the parking lot, they said they saw the group start to disperse. The teen suspect began walking away in a hurried manner with long strides, BPD said, and kept looking back at officers as he quickened his pace again. He continued to look back at the officers before starting to record them. Then he took off toward East Brookline Street and Washington Street, BPD said. As the teen was running, police said he clutched his waistband. Officers then saw a firearm fall out and heard it hit the ground, according to the department. The 17-year-old was arrested, and police said they identified the firearm as a 9mm loaded ghost gun. The suspect's fanny pack also allegedly contained 30 grams of fentanyl pills, 6 grams of crack cocaine, and a knife. Officers charged the suspect with carrying a loaded firearm without a license, possession of a large-capacity feeding device, possession of a firearm in the commission of a felony, possession of ammunition without an FID card, trafficking fentanyl, and possession with intent to distribute Class B drugs. The suspect is expected to be arraigned in Boston Juvenile Court. Police looking for suspect in Museum of African American History arson. Both the Boston Police and National Park Service are investigating an incident involving arson and vandalism at the African Meeting House on Boston Hill. The incident occurred in the early hours of Wednesday morning, according to NPS, who said video footage showed a person opening a package outside the building, removing what was inside, and burning some of the objects in the alley next door. The crime was reported to Boston Police by an employee of the Museum of African American History, which operates the historical site, according to an incident report. Materials inside the package were for Juneteenth, the employee told police. The report noted that the incident was a suspected hate crime motivated by anti-black or African-American bias. According to NPS, the Meeting House is the oldest still existing black church in America. Southern California man survives grizzly bear attack, from the Los Angeles Times. A San Diego man said he feels lucky to be alive and recovering at home this week after surviving a grizzly bear attack at Glacier National Park on May 28th. I'm honestly grateful I still have an arm, said Daniel Crago, 32, in an interview Sunday with the Times. It's pretty painful, but I'm making progress day by day. The attack unfolded the end of the last hike on the last day of a long-awaited trip to the popular Montana Park, which sees more than 3 million visitors annually. Crago, a lifelong outdoor enthusiast who spent his childhood camping in Yosemite and Sequoia, had just taken a few snapshots from the end of the Grinnell Glacier Trail and was headed back to meet his travel companion about 100 yards away when he spotted a grizzly cub just off to his left. Like most Golden State hikers, Crago had long ago learned what to do when confronted with a bear. He stayed calm and still, quickly scanning his surroundings for other grizzlies. What he saw next filled him with terror. There was a larger grizzly, maybe 10 feet above me, Crago said. They tell you to alert the bear to make sure you don't frighten it. I called, "Hey, bear, hey, bear," and as it looked up, it charged at me. With no time to grab his bear spray, Crago said he threw up his right arm to try to shield himself instead. The bear bit through flesh and bone, dragging him for about 20 feet before dropping him and running away. I looked down at my arm and my hand was just kind of dangling, Crago said. It was a full break of both forearm bones, an open wound, blood kind of pouring out. He got up and began running, but dropped to the snow after nearby hikers screamed at him to stop, fearing the bear could charge again. Once down, bystanders quickly rushed to his aid. One, a pediatric ER doctor, wrapped his arm in a makeshift tourniquet and stuffed the wound to staunch the bleeding, while others called for help. Crago's hiking companion helped keep him calm while they waited about an hour for a helicopter to arrive. I just kept putting snow on my face, staying awake, Crago said. I felt like if I passed out, I wouldn't make it. He spent the next 7 days at Logan Hospital in Kalispell, where he endured multiple surgeries to save his arm. Crago said he expects to receive at least one more skin graft and possibly further surgeries to come, with no sense of how long it could take to regain use of his dominant hand or how much he might end up having to pay for life-saving care. Writing is the hardest thing, just signing medical documents, the hiker said. The helicopter itself was $20,000 after insurance coverage, and I haven't seen the bill of the surgery. Despite the pain and uncertainty, Crago said he was overwhelmed with gratitude for the strangers who rushed to his aid on the trail and those who continued to donate to his GoFundMe to help defray medical costs. He said his terrifying encounter with California's most iconic apex predator won't dim his love of nature. It's something that's always been a part of who I am, he said. Warming trend on the way. It's going to feel more like the end of June than the first few weeks, by Colleen Cronin. Summer hasn't officially started yet, but according to the National Weather Service, by midweek it will surely start to feel like it. The forecast shows that most of the state begins the week on the cooler side, NWS Norton's lead meteorologist Andrew Lacanoto said, with temperatures hitting the 70s inland. On the coast, they will stay around the mid to upper 60s. As LeConto said, winds coming off the water will drive temperatures lower. But starting on Tuesday and Wednesday, there will be quite a warming trend, LeConto explained, with thermometers hitting 90 degrees and higher, and heat hits that could stick around into the weekend. It's going to feel more like the end of June than the first few weeks, he said. It's going to be more summer-like. That could bode a warmer summer altogether, with the odds tilted to above normal temperatures in the coming months, he said. While temperatures rise this week, the likelihood of rain will remain low. There could be some precipitation, but LeCanto said it's looking not too optimistic in the forecast. If there is rain, it'll be nothing like a widespread soaking shower, which we really need, he said. The rising temperatures and lack of precipitation go hand in hand, LeCanto explained, saying that dry ground can give warming feedback that can raise temperatures between 2 and 4 degrees. The higher temperatures and lower rainfall also contribute to increasing drought conditions, he said, although he noted that budding trees will help maintain some humidity and decrease the already low chance of forest fires. According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, almost the entire state is currently experiencing some level of abnormal dryness, with some areas experiencing moderate or severe drought. Police search for shooting suspect from the Associated Press. A search in Ohio for suspects who opened fire near a busy street festival stretched into Sunday after 12 people were wounded in the weekend shooting that sent crowds scrambling for cover in a historic Toledo neighborhood. Each of the dozen victims, who authorities say ranged from teenagers to people in their 60s, were in stable condition, the Toledo Police Department said Sunday. No arrests have been made, and authorities have not identified any potential suspects. The gunfire erupted Saturday near the Old West End Festival, a popular annual summer gathering along streets dotted with Victorian homes. Videos posted to social media showed people running at the sound of gunfire and medics tending to the wounded in a park filled with event tents and food trucks. Toledo Deputy Police Chief Joe Heffernan has said it appeared that at least 2 people fired weapons and were probably shooting at each other. As the search for the shooters wore on, Lucas County Prosecutor Julia Bates vowed justice will be swift and strong. Those who were frightened, traumatized, or harmed by this violence will remain at the forefront of our efforts. I've felt outraged before, but this is personal, Bates said in a statement. This is my home. These are my friends and neighbors. It is not okay. In a brief update posted to social media Sunday, Toledo police said investigators were continuing to make progress and were following multiple leads. Authorities have urged festival goers to come forward with any photos or videos that might have caught a glimpse of the suspects. The remainder of the festival was canceled Sunday. Organizers said it would not be compassionate, responsible, or possible to continue through the weekend. We are heartbroken about those who were injured at the Old West End Festival, the festival said in a statement. The victims ranged in age from 14 to 61, with most of them in their early 20s. Fire Chief Allison Armstrong said it was difficult for emergency responders to get the injured to the hospital due to closed roads and traffic leaving the festival, but all were transported within an hour. Kevin Berry was sitting in the neighborhood arboretum listening to live music with friends when he heard gunshots ring out. Everybody hit the deck, he said. When Berry looked back up, he saw a gun being tossed to the ground less than 50 feet away from him. Officers who were already on site for the festival responded immediately. Berry, who has medical training and served in the Navy, walked around looking for anyone who might need help and saw at least 5 people with gunshot wounds. George Crowell, the city's safety director, said the festival is one of the most iconic festivals in Toledo, and it's a shame that something like this had to ruin it, he said. From the business pages, consumers feeling the squeeze. From unfilled gas tanks to fewer frills, retailers see spending patterns change. From the Associated Press, New York. U.S. consumers haven't stopped spending money since the Iran war drove up fuel prices, but many shoppers are reassessing what they buy and where, according to company executives and retail analysts. The behavior changes observed so far are subtle, such as altered routines for buying gasoline and fewer visits to clothing and furniture stores. They also are uneven across the population. During recent earnings calls with analysts, executives from American mainstays like Walmart, McDonald's, and Dollar General cited overall shopper resilience as well as noticeable cutbacks by lower-income customers. But the new signs of strain cited by major retailers as generous income tax refunds helped shore up their sales make some economists and analysts think they will see a wider retrenchment when the refunds are gone and consumers face the cumulative impact of more expensive gas and higher prices for food, clothing, insurance, and other goods and services. Trevor Chapman, a communications executive in West Hills, California, said that instead of going to a local independent gas station, he and his wife now plan their fuel stops around Costco stores with filling stations. Gas is a kind of catalyst, Chapman said. It trickles down into the entire budget. We're trying to keep everything as normal as possible, but it's starting to feel like it's adding up more and more. Well before the U.S. and Israel launched the war, many consumers already were being more choosy with their discretionary purchases, fatigued by several years of stubborn inflation and tariffs on imported goods imposed last year. The U.S. Commerce Department reported last week that higher prices, not more purchases, accounted for most of the growth in American spending in April, when a key inflation gauge reached the highest level since October 2023. Members-only warehouse stores like Costco, Walmart's Sam's Club, and BJ's Wholesale Club have seen more traffic at their fuel pumps since the war began in late February, according to the companies. Fuel typically costs less at the wholesale clubs. But many drivers are not filling their tanks up, Walmart Chief Financial Officer John David Rainey told analysts late last month. For the first time since 2022, Walmart customers and Sam's Club members are buying an average of less than 10 gallons per trip, he said. That's an indication of stress, Rainey said. Costco members also are making changes. They are visiting store gas stations more frequently to top up in between what would have normally been a gap between getting the tank to empty because of the concern about what might the gas price be tomorrow, Chief Financial Officer Gary Millerchip said in late May. Meanwhile, the gas price surge has hurt convenience stores where 80% of all fuel is sold in the U.S., according to Jeff Leonard, a vice president at the National Association of Convenience Stores. A sales analysis by the trade group found the number of pump transactions at the properties of 130 convenience store companies fell by nearly 10% across March and April compared to the same 2 months last year. The number of sales inside the company's stores dropped by 10.4%, according to the analysis. When you lose gallons to the big box, you also lose in-store sales, Leonard said. Consumers also are making concessions when they shop for groceries, according to Stu Leonard, president of an 8-store supermarket chain his father founded, Stu Leonard's. He's noticed customers buying meat in bulk to freeze and being less tempted to buy the products showcased during live food demonstrations or offered for sampling. It's telling me that people are sticking more to their shopping lists, Leonard said. B of A boosts World Cup tickets for veterans first responders. Bank of America, VetTix, and FIFA will provide $2.25 million in free World Cup 2026 tickets to military veterans, current military, and first responders and their families who live in or near World Cup host cities. The tickets will be available starting with the second match played in the U.S. As part of the initiative, B of A will contribute $2 million to VetTix to support the purchase and distribution of match tickets across all 11 U.S. host cities, including Boston, to add to the $250,000 also being provided by VetTix. Tickets will be available from the group stage to the final, with 250 tickets being set aside for U.S. men's national team matches during the tournament in honor of America's 250th anniversary. To be eligible for the tickets, honorably discharged veterans and currently serving military members can sign up for an account at the VetTix website, T-I-X. Actors Union approves new deal. Television and movie actors voted to ratify a four-year contract with studios and streaming services. This comes after union leaders negotiated protections against synthetic actors created by artificial intelligence. The ratification was widely expected, and a strike like the one in 2023 never seemed likely during the drama-free negotiations. More than 90% of Screen Actors Guild American Federation of Television and Radio Artists members approved the agreement late last week. The new deal, like one recently reached by Hollywood writers, is for 4 years instead of the usual three. From the sports pages, Suarez's gem wasted as Sox bullpen implodes. Five-run eighth pushes Yankees past Boston by Gabriel Starr. A pitcher's duel unfolded in the Bronx early Sunday afternoon, and with it the latest reminder that arms aren't the root cause of the 2026 Boston Red Sox problems. After Sunday's game was delayed 20 minutes from its 1:35 p.m. scheduled first pitch, Red Sox starter Ranger Suarez was perfect through the first three innings, while New York Yankees starter Cam Schlittler was effectively wild for much of his 5 2/3 innings. But when all was said and done, the Yankees took Sunday's game 6-1 because they did what the Red Sox too often don't this season, create and capitalize on scoring opportunities. Schlittler's command wasn't close to the devastating level that the Red Sox suffered through in Game 3 of last year's wildcard round, but he had more than enough to get by, thanks in large part because the opposing lineup let him off the hook. The Red Sox were 0-2 with runners in scoring position during Schlittler's innings and charged him with just one earned run on four hits, one walk, and five strikeouts. Boston batters opted not to challenge several Schlittler pitches out of the zone, but that was only a small piece of the problem pie. They managed just five base runners against him and wasted the first three, Sedan Rafaela's one-out single in the first, Anthony Siegler's leadoff walk in the third, and two-out double in the fifth. Frenetic wins robbed Willier Abreu of a go-ahead two-run homer in the sixth, but Wilson Contreras' subsequent line drive made contact with the left field wall for a game-tying RBI double and knocked Schlittler out of the game. But righty reliever Fernando Cruz needed two pitches to retire Masataka Yoshida and end the threat. Siegler made his first start for the Red Sox, batting eighth and playing second base. He reached base twice. Siegler also successfully used the ABS system when he led up the third with a walk, but advanced no further than second base as Schlittler retired the next three men in order. Mickey Gasper led off the seventh with a single, and Andrew Monasterio, pinch-hitting for Siegler, greeted left-hander Brent Hedrick with a one-out single. But Isaiah Kiner-Falefa grounded into an inning-ending double play to quash Boston's best-scoring bid of the afternoon. Suarez held the Yankees to one earned run on six hits, issued zero walks, and struck out six in 6 1/3 innings. He threw 90 pitches, 59 for strikes, and racked up 17 swing and misses. I feel good, Suarez told reporters via translator. The fifth, the sixth, and the seventh, I felt good and strong, so yeah. Your focus as a starter is to get deep into the game, six, seven, eight innings. Obviously, it was good to be out there and to throw six and get into the seventh inning. The Sox Southpaw's perfect game bid ended when the Yankees loaded the bases with two outs in the fourth on a Paul Goldschmidt leadoff single, one-out single by left fielder Cody Bellinger, and two-out single by Trent Grisham. Suarez escaped thanks to an Anthony Volpe line-out, lineout, but New York took a 1-0 lead the following frame on a Jose Caballero double and Goldschmidt RBI single that looped just out of Abreu's reach in right field. Boston is 7-26 when opponents score first. Sunday marked Suarez's first start of at least 6 innings since April 27th. He was in elite form as he navigated around a Grisham two-out double in the 6th and briefly returned for the bottom of the 7th. Red Sox interim manager Chad Tracy was in aggressive management mode and came out to take the ball from his starter after a leadoff strikeout to Jazz Chisholm Jr. Suarez didn't look happy as he returned to the visitor's dugout and watched righty Tyrone Guerrero take over, but a quick snag and throw to first by Gasper retired Caballero for the 2nd out of the 7th, and Suarez's frustration didn't prevent him from looking impressed when Guerrero ended the inning by getting Yankees prospect Spencer Jones swinging on a 102.8-mile-per-hour sinker. With top setup man Garrett Whitlock rehabbing in AAA Worcester, fellow righty reliever Justin Slayton took the mound for the bottom of the 8th. Slayton began in top form, overpowering Goldschmidt and likely American League MVP contender Ben Rice, but Bellinger retook the lead for New York with a home run to right center. Third baseman Ahmad Rosario followed with a single, stole second, and scored New York's 3rd run on Grisham's RBI single. Grisham's steal of 2nd and Slayton's walk to Volpe necessitated another pitching change. On came lefty Joe LaSorsa, acquired last week from the Pittsburgh Pirates, to make his Red Sox debut, and Chisholm greeted him with a first-pitch 3-run homer that doubled New York's lead. Yankees closer David Bednar made easy work of Contreras, Yoshida, and Gasper in the top of the 9th. The Yankees bullpen retired the last 7 Sox from Kenner Falefa's 7th-inning double play onward. "It's still a really good baseball game," Tracy told reporters. "You maybe feel that way if you feel like you went out and laid an egg, but you played a really good baseball game, and they get a couple runs in the bottom of the 8th, obviously." The series will remain unresolved until August 29th, when the Red Sox play a split doubleheader to recoup the June 7th rainout. Lucic officially calls it a career, announces retirement. On his 38th birthday, former Boston Bruins star Milan Lucic, one of the most ferocious power forwards of his generation, announced his retirement from the game on Sunday via social media. Lucic, voted one of the top 100 Bruins during the club's centennial celebration 3 years ago, played 1,177 games in the National Hockey League, and last played in the elite Ice Hockey League in Britain, playing 26 games for Fife in 2025-26. "Looking back on my career, I feel truly grateful to have fulfilled my dream of playing professional hockey, culminating with a Stanley Cup win in 2011 with the Boston Bruins," he wrote in a release through the NHLPA. "I want to especially thank the Bruins for giving me my start in professional hockey and for instilling the confidence to reach new heights as a player." Drafted in the 2nd round of the 2006 draft that also brought Phil Kessel and Brad Marchand to Boston, the 6'3", 236-pound Lucic played the first 566 NHL games with the Bees. He embodied what be a Big Bad Bruins 2.0 team that won the Cup, dropping the gloves whenever needed and bringing a bone-rattling physicality to his game. He amassed 1,301 penalty minutes in his career, but he also had some touch around the net. He finished with 233, 353, 586 totals throughout his career. His most productive year was the Cup season of 2010 and 11, when his line was 30, 32, 62. He also played with the Kings, Oilers, and Flames over 8 seasons. Lucic had 2 stints with the Bruins, the 2nd of which in 2023-24 did not last long nor end well. He suffered a broken foot in the 4th game of the season, and while he was on the shelf, he was charged in a domestic violence incident at his home in Boston. He went into the league's player assistance program, and the charges were eventually dropped when his wife, Brittany, declined to testify, but he never played another game in the NHL. And that's all we've got for today. Have yourselves a good Monday.